Welcome to the Cynical Podcast, a weekly discussion of current events in China. I'm your host, Kaiser Guo, finally back here at the pop-up Chinese studios in Beijing after a long time on the road and an unfortunate mishap that resulted in the deletion of our recording from last week. We are going to make up for that, and so welcome to the Deja Vu All Over Again edition. Joining me today are Jeremy Goldkorn, the man behind the incomparable DanWei.org. How are you, Jeremy?
Hi, Kaiser.
Will Moss, PR guy extraordinaire and author of the much-loved blog Image Thief.
Hey, Kaiser.
Great to have you back, Will. We're joined again by Gotti Epstein, we're using Stalwart again, a Seneca Stalwart and Bureau Chief
of Forbes. I'm going to go look up Stalwart. Seneca recidivist, I think.
Recidivism, yeah. He's a Seneca addict.
Who are you calling Stalwart?
And finally, we're joined again by Mary Kay Magistad from Public Radio International. Thanks again for joining us.
Good to be here.
And I want to make a quick plug again for a series that Mary Kay is doing this week on coal in China, on China's coal habit, is it called?
China's coal habit.
That's right, on PRI's The World. So make sure to give that a listen. It's one of my very, very favorite podcasts. Say hi to Marco for me, by the way.
I will do that.
Thank you. This week again, Deja Vu, we've decided to revisit some of the topics from the infamous lost episode of Seneca. Unfortunately, we are going to sound sort of repetitious. I mean, here everyone's got to do their best not to sound like they're just repeating talking points.
Well, personally, I'm honored to be crashing your Deja Vu moment.
Yeah, well, it's what makes it not so sort of dull and familiar.
Any truth to the rumor, though, Kaiser, that the podcast was lost intentionally while discussions were ongoing about selling us off to some
There we are with selling us again.
We tried to do that while you were gone.
Frank Liu ordered that podcast destroyed.
I still think the Double Harmony Fish Oil Company could get a lot of value out of it.
They really could. They probably could.
This show brought to you by Double Harmony Fish Oil.
Indeed.
For all your frying needs.
So rather than just try to reconstruct all the wit and wisdom that we imparted last week, we're going to add some things, of course. And one of those things are the China-related bits of the WikiLeaks leaks, the diplomatic cables, all 250,000 of which were given again to the Times and the Guardian. And who else? Some German?
Der Spiegel.
Der Spiegel, yeah.
60 El Pais. Red, 249,980-something to go.
Good math, Will. Good math. Okay. So anyway, a small percentage of those are actually online right now, but we're all waiting with bated breath, as it were, for the rest of them. We're going to also talk about Crazy Bad, the air quality tweet that came out of the U.S. Embassy here, about the woman Chen Jianping, who was apparently sentenced to a year of reform through labor for a tweet. We'll talk about the planned NASDAQ IPO of China's two leading video sites, Tudou and Youku, and the tragic fire of November 15th in Shanghai. Let's jump right in with Crazy Bad. I felt like it was pretty crazy bad today. I don't know. I mean,
right. The air today, Wednesday, is over 300.
Okay.
Your mind back 2 weeks to when you could feel it in your eyes. You could feel it in your throat. You felt sort of lightheaded and dizzy. I was checking the U.S. Embassy air monitor every couple of hours because I was thinking, I don't remember it being this bad.
Yeah,
and indeed, it was in the 400s and then 500. And I actually saw it the hour that it hit crazy bad.
Oh, wow. You saw it. So you
I don't remember everything.
I can't believe I'm in the same room with someone.
Was some kind of Getty thing where people were like,
Yeah, I saw crazy bad.
I saw crazy bad, too. I saw it when I woke up at 8 in the morning.
I'm looking at it right now, actually.
Yeah, indeed.
So apparently they needed something beyond hazardous, right? I mean, hazardous peaks at what?
Maybe hazardous
recap exactly what this means.
Okay, so right.
So 100 is where it's already unhealthy for people who have asthma or the very young or the very old.
This is as measured by the U.S. Embassy's
international standards.
Right, I know. Right, it's the rating at the U.S. Embassy, one intake, and it's Beijing Air on Twitter.
And it's measuring small particulate matter.
So on the day in question, it went above 500.
Above 500.
And the U.S. Embassy's tweets.
History, because we're talking like everybody who listens knows exactly what this is all about. The U.S. Embassy in Beijing has an air monitoring station and has a Twitter stream that reports its own set of readings on the air quality in Beijing, which people often take as a counterpoint to the official Chinese readings.
The difference being that they measure larger particles only and not the 500 nanometer or smaller particles, which are actually more damaging.
Yeah, 2.5.
And also that the Chinese stats for Beijing are drawn from a number of stations, including some in Yanqing and Huairou, which are in the countryside, where the air is a little
sometimes
cleaner.
Better.
And possibly in Switzerland. I believe one of their monitoring stations is in
so
Switzerland.
So on the day in question, the U.S. Embassy recorded over 500, which is, you
200
know,
points above which hazardous, which in the United States would get schools shut down and people would be told to just stay indoors.
It peaked at 569.
And they treated it, instead of hazardous or unhealthy, they treated crazy bad.
Right, crazy bad.
And we're all obsessing about this because we breathe this stuff.
We do.
On a regular basis.
It's also just, it rung true. When you saw the words crazy bad, you're like, yes, that's exactly
right. Well, that was the beauty of it, because normally the tweets, particularly the embassy tweets, you know, the verdicts about how bad the air are delivered in technical language. So what is it? It's unhealthy for sensitive groups.
Unhealthy.
Very unhealthy. And hazardous.
And then that's it.
And then right. That's beyond index.
But right. Some
and then hazardous just goes on into infinity until you're dead.
But some programmer with a sense of humor clearly thought you needed to have a new category. So he put it in. The U.S. Embassy the next day was sort of scrambling and saying, oh, that was an inaccurate description of the air quality.
It was completely accurate.
Did anyone actually ever talk to the embassy?
John Watts from The Guardian.
The environment did as well. And I talked to the embassy that day as well. I mean, they basically,
who did you talk to?
I talked to someone in the press section.
Okay.
Because there's a guy on Twitter in the press section whose Twitter name I think is Richard Buangguan.
That's his name, right? Right. I did not talk to him. I talked to a deputy press officer.
Buangguan. Buangguan. Richard Buangguan.
I just wanted to say that name.
What was the official embassy response to Crazy Bad?
It was an inaccurate description. They're fixing the monitor.
when they're taking out the crazy bad, they are.
And then there was the additional comment of, we thought we'd get into trouble for this, but in fact, it seems from the responses we're getting on Twitter that we've become sort of like heroes.
Well, if there is some kind of, you know, protest from the Chinese, I'm sure they'll find a record of it in the WikiLeaks things.
Well, what we've seen since then is they're now going to begin hourly reporting of the Chinese Beijing government,
the Beijing municipal government, right?
That's a
are they going to use crazy bad?
Jeremy?
I hope so, but I somehow doubt it.
Well, we need to come up with a good translation for crazy bad.
We should come up with a good phrase.
Not quite the same.
There'll definitely be some sort of euphemism.
It's clear just from the sort of level of excitement here that my wife is right. She thinks that we foreigners living in Beijing take some sort of perverse pleasure.
Of course we do.
Yes.
Like my hometown, Johannesburg. In Johannesburg, we're very proud of being the murder and rape capital of the world. South Africans who live in Johannesburg will spend dinner parties regaling each other with the stories of their neighbors who were hijacked with four guys with AK-47s. But the neighbors of the neighbors were hijacked with eight guys
with AK-47s. Right, you got to one-up, right.
I totally agree. Your wife is absolutely right. Air pollution, much as we hate it.
Hear that, honey?
It's one of those things. You are right, Tantan. It's one of those things that brings us all together as a group here. It's our kumbaya thing here in Beijing.
It gives us bragging rights. Yeah. We're breathing some of the worst air on the planet.
That's right. We rule. I mean, you know, crazy bad that is.
Right. So, I mean, everyone follows this Twitter feed now. I mean, I haven't actually seen the number because, you know, Twitter has become a real kind of community for a lot of the expats here. Twitter is also essentially the virtual opposition these days, right? And for a long time, I think, I was actually shocked to have gotten – I won't out this person – a reputable reporter was under the impression that things that you say on Twitter are entirely out of earshot, or the government doesn't somehow care what you say. But that was proven to be completely wrong. We'd seen evidence of this before. But when a woman named Chen Jianping tweeted what was clearly a sort of facetious retweet of something her husband had written, calling for the smashing of the Japanese pavilion at the expo, just in mockery of the stridency of anti-Japanese nationalists, she added, "Charge, angry youth!" You know, her own three characters at the end of it, and she was apparently sentenced to a year of hard labor. What are the lessons to be drawn from this?
We're watching. When we think you're provoking unrest, we're going to come after you, or at least we might come after you. So think before you write.
That's right. I mean,
but also, I mean, in this case, it wasn't just the tweet. She and her husband were people of interest to the local security police for some time. So, I mean, you know, this may have been either the straw that broke the camel's back or the excuse that the security police.
But their activism was in something completely innocuous. I mean, it's like,
she's been involved in a number of different things, but one of the things that she helped with was exposing the story of kids working in horrible conditions in brick kilns in Shanxi.
In Shanxi province, right.
Maybe the other thing is to be extremely cautious when leveling threats, even mocking threats at glossy national projects like the Expo.
Or, yeah, the Asian Games or the Olympics or what have you, right? And I think the most important lesson is that the Communist Party censors have no sense at all of humor. I mean, you don't assume that they have any.
Well, they're censors.
Right. That's true. They're not
allowed. And one should also say, I mean, one has to mention the Robin Hood Airport case in England recently where a guy tweeted, is it in Newcastle? Somewhere in the north.
It would be Sherwood Forest, I think.
He tweeted he's going to – yeah, it must be near Nottingham. He's going to blow up the airport because of flight delays or something. And he is in trouble, I think. He's been accused of basically the kind of crime, shouting fire in a packed theater. I don't remember if he's been sentenced or not.
It's a bad era for making terrorism jokes online.
Of any kind.
Or in airports.
Yeah. Yeah. Or in airports. Yeah, sorry.
There was a
however, during the anarchist period in the late 19th century, it was much better time to make
Twitter back then. Twitter was great back then. Those are the good old days.
That's what I tell people.
Let's not forget that there was a great story. I don't know if you've heard it on This American Life about a guy who had made similar threats about they weren't really threats. He was talking about going in with an AR-15 and shooting up an Apple Genius bar because he had gotten really poor service at one. And within minutes of putting this on Facebook, he had a SWAT team at his door.
Wow.
I think he was okay. He's one of these guys who just didn't know when to shut up.
Yeah, but he was sort of enmeshed in the machine for a while after that. I remember that story.
But this is just another example, I guess, of our new digital reality. I mean, WikiLeaks and Facebook and Twitter are all different sides of the same issue we're dealing with, which is that we have to find a new way to communicate when the things we say can be taken out of context, the things we say can be copied, they can be given to a website to publish, they can be watched by the cops. And none of us, nobody anywhere, has figured out exactly what the new rules of the communication game are.
Now that, I mean, Jerry mentions WikiLeaks, let's jump into that. What was interesting that you saw, not related to Korea, which we've already talked about, that came out of the batch of cables that were from the U.S. Embassy here in Beijing? There was this reference, of course, to the Operation Aurora attacks of December of 2009 that prompted Google's exit.
Right. Yes. We haven't seen that cable.
Those bloody teasers, Assange and The Guardian and The New York Times and Der Spiegel.
The best cables about
those teasers, they won't release those cables
yet. The best cables about China right now are ones that aren't yet from the embassy in Beijing yet, I think. Like, for instance, the one out of Kyrgyzstan.
Where
the ambassador is
tried
to
buy off.
Yeah, he's caught stumbling suddenly in his Russian when asked whether China offered to pay off Kyrgyzstan $3 billion to close its U.S. base. And then that led to an interest. I mean, the whole cable is pretty interesting to read. And at the end, an aide who had remained studiously quiet, an aide to the Chinese ambassador, jumps in with an extremely unwise remark about how, why don't you guys pay us pay the Kyrgyz $5 billion and buy both the Russians and the Chinese off.
Maybe that I was wrong about officials not having a sense of humor.
And then the Chinese ambassador gives him a horrified glare, according to the cable.
Which we've seen or not seen. I didn't find
that cable one. Is out there.
Okay, that's from the
But
Kyrgyz.
That's not from the embassy in Beijing.
That's from Bishkek.
Yes.
Okay, all right. I'll need to look that one up. Anything else? I mean, what about – okay, so you're just you won't care to speculate on this
whole – There was the characterization of Wu Dawei.
Ah, right.
And who is described as one of the most incompetent Chinese officials and a Red Guard. Do you remember the whole thing?
Marxist-sprouting Red Guard.
And hard to communicate with because he doesn't speak English.
And Wu Dawei is
– Imagine that.
Yeah.
Who exactly?
Vice foreign minister. He's
the vice foreign minister, and he was described like this by the South Korean
The South Korean official, I think, then went on to become the national security advisor. My memory is.
And this was in connection with North Korea, and this is one of the people who's
frustrations about the six-party talks and who is involved on the Chinese side.
And then there were some very boring ones out of Japan talking about how Wen Jiabao seemed to be tired, but that Hu Jintao was full of vitality.
Wen Jiabao did seem to be tired last March during the National People's Congress. That was quite noticeable. Interesting that made it into a cable.
Very interesting.
We have no idea really what it means, and he's still
around.
What
about Google? Let's go back to Google. I mean, that's of interest to me. Any thoughts on that? I mean, was this a smoking gun?
Do we believe it?
Well, first of all, the New York Times and The Guardian put this in. They both have teased to this. But in different ways. And I feel like the Guardian's tease, and I'm a little bit suspicious based on the way that they characterized the North Korea cables, which were that, suddenly China is ready for a unified Korea. So now I'm a little bit wary of how they describe a cable out of context. I'd like to see it.
So, I mean, just to provide a little
context. The Guardian said that the intrusion, the attack on Google, the hack, was ordered by the Politburo after a Chinese – a member of the Politburo Standing Committee.
What was it, the Standing Committee? It said Standing Committee?
No, it said a member of the Politburo in the cable.
So it was either the nine guys or the 24 guys.
Probably the nine, though, right. I think is what it's meant to imply. And searched himself on Google, Googled himself.
And who hasn't done
and
that?
Didn't like the results, saw some negative result. The notion that I can totally believe that happened, that one of the leaders Googled themselves, I think they probably all do. And I've written to that effect this week. But the notion that they would order an attack on Google based on that one data point, I think, strains credulity.
Attack, it seems to me if the government's going to be annoyed with you and you're an internet firm, particularly a foreign one, there are many more subtle ways they could make your life miserable by, for instance, making sure that your ICP doesn't get renewed or what have you.
And oddly, they actually did renew their ICP license.
Right. There's clearly a whole range of other factors involved in this, whatever happened with Google and whatever the Chinese government, if they were involved – would have wanted out of that, or whatever elements of the Chinese government.
I have to say, when it comes to this particular type of thing, both the blocking of websites and the hacking activities that may or may not be in some way supported by the Chinese government, I have yet to find a single credible source. I mean, after my own website was blocked, I spent a bit of time trying to figure out who I could talk to. And I mean, I am maybe a country bumpkin from Africa, but I've been working in Chinese media and internet for, the better part of 15 years. And it's not easy to find anyone who knows anything. There are quite a lot of people who confidently speculate on what happens, on why things get blocked or what is going on. It's not very easy to find people who know all the real secrets.
We'll put you in touch with Jimmy Wales. Apparently he knew the right guys to get Wikipedia unblocked.
Apparently he did, yeah.
But WikiLeaks is apparently blocked.
Right. I'm surprised it took him this long to get around to that. I mean, now that there's egg on China's face, of course, they need to do that.
Right. Also, the whole notion of leaking secret government documents is not something that I think the Chinese government wants to sort of encourage people to be happy about.
I really wonder what conversations are going on in the back rooms there.
Gotti, you yourself mentioned the potential of a Chinese competitor.
I wrote about this yesterday.
Shanghai WikiLeaks.
Shanghai WikiLeaks. I wrote about this on Forbes.
Oh, Julian Assange does not like that idea.
Right, exactly. So this week's...
No, because only he is responsible enough to release secret cables.
Yes, I did include that rather ironic quote in the headline, which was, "It's very dangerous to do this wrong." And of course, it begs the question of whether there is a right way to do it. Julian Assange was interviewed by my colleague in New York. He was interviewed in London by my colleague Andy Greenberg for 2 hours. It's a cover package in this next issue of Forbes, or the current one that just hit the newsstands. And this tidbit in the interview, and it's the only reference he made to this in the interview, he was asked about, what about copycat WikiLeaks? And he said, I've encountered a few of them, and it's very dangerous if you just kind of go about it willy-nilly, basically, is what he's saying. And he said he actually was approached by the Chinese WikiLeaks and that they had communications. They invited Chinese WikiLeaks, which I believe is referring to the government leaks, what self-described, self-named government leaks that the South China Morning Post reported last month.
See, they're just
which plans to launch next June. And he said they have no reputation you can trust, whatever that means, and that they have no real security at this point. And it said it's very dangerous to do it wrong.
See, WikiLeaks can be like every other internet firm on the planet and get frozen out of China. Local competitors can get all the good links.
Right, exactly. Yet the domestic – I don't think the government will be supporting this one. And, of course, there's much higher risk here for – I mean anybody who is caught associating with a Chinese version of WikiLeaks –
But I have to say, I mean, the guy is a bit ridiculous. I mean, the source of
Julian Assange is a bit ridiculous.
Yeah, the source of these latest leaks, right, the diplomatic cables and the Iraq war logs, as far as one can tell, is the same guy as Bradley Manning,
right,
who is now jailed. So it's a bit ridiculous to claim if other people do it, it's not secure because they won't have the right technology, right? I mean
– Well, we'll see. I mean WikiLeaks now has – they'll have other leaks coming. And this was one of the subjects of this Forbes story is his next leak is going to be a private sector one. It's going to be a bank, a major U.S. bank. Mm. It looks like it might be Bank of America because WikiLeaks has said already, Julian Assange said in a past interview like a year ago that he has a five gigs of – a file of a Bank of America executive, and he doesn't know what to do with it. So that's interesting.
That's what
and so we'll see with future leaks. Have they protected
something
their
sources? From Wikipedia about WikiLeaks. I've got it open in front of me right now. This is interesting. The organization has described itself as having been founded by Chinese dissidents, as well as journalists, mathematicians, and startup company technologists from the U.S., Taiwan, Europe, Australia, and South Africa. Where's the China stuff?
Right. We haven't seen. And I think there's been a lot of questions about that claimed provenance.
Right. It's sort of a strange one. And then why all the objection to Chinese?
Also, I mean, if you want to get hold of sensitive Chinese documents, Chinese dissidents are not the people to ask to get these documents.
Right. But these folks, the government leaks folks whose founder was identified as originally as Deep Throat in the South China Morning Post story, says that they are soliciting uploads of classified data to their database. We'll see who does that. Yeah. But as you note, there's lots of stuff already leaked that's considered state secrets and confidential by the Chinese government right now.
Where's
that
China's Bradley Manning?
Any of those directives from the quote-unquote the Ministry of Truth are considered secret. We already have a Chinese journalist who went to jail for 10 years for revealing the directives related to the 15th anniversary of Tiananmen Square, Shi Tao. There's already people leaking out there.
I also think that Chinese government officials are far more reluctant to commit their thoughts to either paper or electronic forms than – I mean Americans are all addicted to email. My own dealings –
Politburo uses QQ, actually.
Business dealings with the Chinese government is you don't ever really communicate stuff by email. You do it – I mean at the most you might do it by chat, but people who work in the government don't do that.
Aren't the journalists in the room still faxing their requests into government offices? When
absolutely,
you want to
right. Yeah. So, because they don't have the same communication habits and communication tools and are much more paranoid about what they say, it's a lot more difficult to get hold of sensitive documents.
Right. Many, many communications are done orally by phone.
Yeah.
But – obviously, there's going to be exceptions to that. I would imagine that there'll be some interesting stuff that would come out if they succeed.
What I think would be most interesting is China has a lot of archives. It has very extensive secret police archives covering, such interesting episodes in history as the Cultural Revolution and the Great Leap Forward, the events of 1989.
I thought the official history of those was already out.
There's another one that's not revealed. There are archives. So, that could be interesting. But in terms of, say, diplomatic cables or something, I imagine it would be much more difficult to get hold of content.
The next dynasty always writes the old dynasty's history, right? I need to recuse myself from the next conversation that we're going to be having, which is about the upcoming listings of China's leading video sites, Youku, where I used to work as a consultant. Thus my recusal, plus the fact that I have I work for Baidu, which has, of course, its own majority share in a Hulu-like site called Qiyi. So have at it, guys. How is the market going to react to back-to-back listings if indeed they both go forward?
China's video sites. On the one hand, they are both, I mean, unarguably just iconic sites. They're right. Major fixtures of the Chinese internet landscape, used by literally hundreds of millions of Chinese.
Right. Youku and Tudou are right now the clear leaders in this space in China, in the sort of YouTube / Hulu space. Your Qiyi over there is, I'm sure, starting to nip at their heels. But Youku appears to be winning the race, and I think that's important to get to the market first, to the capital markets first.
And why
is
that?
They'll be listing on NYSE, I think, as soon as next week or perhaps the week thereafter. And their valuation is like over $1 billion. And the reason is, I think Tudou wanted to get to IPO first, but they've had some problems, and all reports are that they're going to have to delay, and that they're going to go around Chinese New Year or before Chinese New Year. So that would be, you know, late January. The reason it would be good to go now is there's a ton of excitement about Chinese IPOs, whether or not they're, you know, these companies are making money. And Youku is going to be the first to cash in of the online video sites.
They're not making money right now. They're still bleeding.
They're bleeding money, and they're actually, unless Tudou's financial numbers aren't accurate, and we'll see whether any of this stuff about having to delay the IPO is related to their accounting. Youku is bleeding a lot more money than Tudou. Tudou is looking to turn profitable sooner. But Youku has more viewers, and it does have a little bit more revenue. I think time will tell whether investors are going to get anything out of this. But there's a lot of risks for investors. And if you read the prospectuses, you can see the risks are right in there. They have to list them, and there's a ton of them. And a lot of it has to do with the state sector. They have
they're internet firms in China. What can go wrong?
Right. It's content, which of course the government cares about.
Too, right?
Sure. There's a lot of competitors, including private competitors like yours, Kaiser at Baidu, but also other platforms that have video as well. And then there's the fact that advertising revenue is very important to the state sector, state television and provincial television channels. And as they try to take away that television advertising revenue, which is really where they need to get some of their growth out of, it'll be interesting to see whether there's pushback.
Jeremy, do you have anything to add? I mean, talk about sort of, you know, what these sites have represented in China on the sort of, you know, as part of the topography of internet culture here.
Well, I mean, you called them iconic. I think, you know, iconic is a word that is sadly abused in our modern times, but they certainly are major parts of the Chinese internet landscape and huge user bases, huge fan bases, essentially. And I mean, they both, I think, will be able to find a way to make money out of the huge user base they have. It's perhaps representative of the sort of mafia environment of the Chinese internet, the stories that have been coming out about Tudou in the last couple of days, really, about the reasons for delaying the filing. The one story has been that Gary Wang, the CEO, had violated what is it called, the quiet period. You're not supposed to talk about something, and if you talk about it, the SEC people
right.
Get
did
angry.
He did an interview with Christy Lou Stout at CNN, right?
Right, and you know, there's been kind of tabloidy reports about his, you know, getting a divorce and his wife making trouble or something, and it's quite difficult to know what to believe because these reports are appearing on online media, and you know, some of them may just be scandalous nonsense. I think you know, from a user point of view, I like both sites equally, and they're both interesting in slightly different ways in terms of the content on them. My one gripe about Youku is that they have never made it easy for a Mac user to upload videos.
But what's relevant about the IPO dates and about this rumors about Tudou is if Tudou is – basically, the Youku could absorb a lot of the investor interest in online video. So even if Tudou numbers might look better, also the climate for Chinese IPOs might change, or IPOs in general might change in 2 months.
So some of the recent IPOs that we've seen go, like China Cash was losing money, and it still went out, and it had a pretty – you know, fairly good run.
Right. There's been a bunch of IPOs. Some of them have come down in price, and a couple of them have blown up. And I'm actually researching a story about Chinese IPOs right now. You know, one company that is doing fine, Country Style Chicken, is that's one I plan to mention in my upcoming post. It's basically a KFC of China coming out of Chongqing.
That sounds like the one to put your money into.
Well, they're, I mean, yeah.
Chicken.
Chinese do like their chicken.
Can't go wrong
with the fried chicken. With the internet firms, I speak from experience and two collapsed entrepreneurial ventures, you can go wrong.
You can go very wrong, but if you don't go wrong, you can go really, really right, which is why people will invest in both of these companies.
Right. If you happen to bet on the quote-unquote YouTube or Hulu of China that wins, then that could be really good.
Yeah, if you would happen to bet on Baidu, when we went out at $27 and 5 years later to the date, we were trading at 38
still
times.
Waiting on Baidu. I'm still waiting.
So who in the room will be putting cash into Tudou or Youku? Anybody?
Well, I can't. I'd like to note, as a Forbes writer, I'm not investing in any individual stocks, period. No China play at all.
Well played.
Okay. Last topic and a big meaty one, the Shanghai fire, something we talked about last week on the last episode. A tragic fire took the life of 58 people in Shanghai on November 15th after sparks from an arc welder ignited flammable netting materials, which were being used in a retrofit to make the building, I guess kind of ironically, more green and energy efficient. And now it's quite blackened. In the days since, we've seen a very unusual mea culpa from Shanghai officials, including the mayor. Compensation offers of close to ~1 million yuan per victim, that's about $140,000. A week after the fire, we had a huge crowd numbering, 10,000? I've heard estimates even higher.
There were some media reports that suggested hundreds of thousands.
Yeah,
I think the more reliable of them was probably in the tens of thousands.
Even tens of thousands is pretty
huge.
Impressive.
Huge.
Under the circumstances.
More than 500 is considered a public security risk in China.
I had the very distinct sense that they were out there for more than just mourning the victims of the fire. I mean, 58 people die all the time in mining accidents, in ferry boat capsizes, and all sorts of other horrible things. But it doesn't bring tens or as many tens of thousands of people out into the street in a major metropolitan area. What was going on here, Mary Kay?
Well, I think there are a number of things going on, not just in Shanghai, but in many cities in China that are growing very quickly. Construction quality isn't always what it should be. Officials are not always as straight as they should be. Corruption can buy a lot of slack in terms of how you're building a building and what kind of safety features you put into it. And I think part of it is frustration. Part of it is that Shanghai homeowners increasingly feel they have a right to speak out. I mean, there have been previous situations like with the high-speed train in Shanghai where people organized together online and through Twitter and within their communities where they had bought apartments or townhouses and insisted that the government change the plans. Said, look, we're worried about the noise. We're worried about the safety of having a train that close, having a magnetic train that close. We're not going to put up with it.
So it's the empowerment of the middle class.
At least a little bit. I mean, I think there's on the one hand frustration and on the other hand a feeling of we have a right to say that we think this doesn't cut it and you need to do better than this.
And it was documented so very well. There were people on the scene with mobile phones and digital cameras uploading to the internet as the fire was happening before there was even an official death toll. It was not possible to downplay this fire in the media.
One of the things that struck me, Gadi, was this willingness to cop to plead guilty to the mayor. His name is Han Zheng, took blame for this for lax safety oversight. I mean, he said, these are his words, inadequate surveillance and shoddy work standards in our city's construction industry led to the fire on November 15th, for which we bear responsibility. This was a statement he made on the municipal government's website.
Right. This is a modern era sort of public accountability measure that Will Moss will tell you is good public relations that China has not done much of in the past but now has to do because of what Jeremy was just talking about.
So, Will,
the story can't be covered up.
As the main PR dude here, how did they handle it? Do you think that it was well done here?
Surprisingly good, considering the track record in China. I think what Gadi says is right. It stands out by contrast against a history of trying to cover things up. We're trying to minimize the negative public perceptions in very ham-fisted ways, or being very reluctant to pay compensation after disasters. I think some of that has to do with the things that Jeremy was talking about the fact that there simply was no There was no hiding this. There's no hiding something.
And they made no effort to, right? Is that right, Jeremy? The censorship was actually fairly limited on this story, right?
I mean, there were directives reported by the Ministry of Truth website, which purports to
China Digital publish. Times ran that, too,
and
right?
China Digital Times translates these directives from various propaganda institutions that sought to control the coverage of the fire. But no, it was done with a very light touch. There was a lot of discussion of this on the Chinese internet, and it didn't seem to be interfered with all that much.
So in crisis management, there's a little mnemonic, CAP, CAP, stands for concern, action, provide perspective, right? You have to demonstrate that you have concern for the victims. You have to be clear about the actions you're going to take to resolve the problem. Perspective is the kind of PR spin part of this where you're like, and here's our point of view on this. I actually think, you know, in being very fast with the compensation, being very clear about where the problems were, the mayor in his statement was hitting that pretty well. As always, the big question will be what happens once this has blown over, and will there be any substantial change? Will the action prove to be real? And what happens the next time, if there is a next time something like this happens in Shanghai? This is the city where just about 2 years ago, an entire building under construction tipped over wholesale. So it's not beyond the realm of possibility that we could see some other large property-related problem,
Of buildings already built. But I guess one big question is what will happen now with safety and inspections for buildings that are being built?
I think we're seeing a new vigilance, right? Is that what? I'm too understanding. I'm given to understand
that's
that.
That's going to be a systemic, permanent.
Yeah,
you know, reform.
Maybe just sort of a.
It's more
ad hoc
like
reaction
what happens
to
is a disaster like this happens, and then there's a measurement, a decision that's made about what will make this situation go away, and what is the best course? And social stability is the number one, priority. And in this particular case, they made this decision for this very strong reaction, and it was the right call.
So, but this is another kind of classic situation with crisis-prone organizations, because it's very easy to come out and say all the right things, and it's even easy to write a few checks. The problem comes when you establish a pattern of problems and trying to break that, and that's really the challenge for them now.
Well, I mean, it happens every day in China. There's things like, in the same Ministry of Truth directives, you have things like, there's a bridge collapse in Wuhan or something, and they say news organizations are advised not to describe it as a bridge collapse, but as a, insert euphemism here.
Structural uncertainty.
I think the chances of it causing anything meaningful to happen at a national level are about 0.0. I think the question worth discussing is whether it might make anything meaningful happen at a metropolitan level.
That's
what
I'm saying. Which it might very well. I mean, Shanghai, let's face it, Shanghai is a pretty together city in many ways. I mean, I think if you look to Singapore as the future of Shanghai, it's not going to be a place that's ever well known for the vitality of its political discussion. But as a clean, modern, safe city, I think Shanghai probably does have a hope of instituting the right safety standards, if any Chinese city does.
Great, guys. Actually, thanks a lot. This, I think, maybe even was better than the one that it replaced, but thanks for coming in, and especially thanks for joining me, Mary Kay, again.
Oh, my pleasure.
And we look forward to having you back on the show again. Jeremy, as usual, Gotti, and Will, good to see you guys.
Thank you, Kaiser.
Thank you, Kaiser.
We'll
and
see
I'm
you.
Valuing Seneca at this point at $1.5 billion.
Frank, Leo, give us a call.
We'll see you next time. Take care. Bye-bye.